From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is the 50th anniversary of VE Day, the day the Germans surrendered to the Allied forces in Europe. On today's Fresh Air, we ask two veterans to share some of their war memories. We'll talk with Tony Verone, who served with the 9th Infantry Division. He fought in Africa and Southern Europe. Now he commands his VFW post. And we'll hear from Donald Pierce, who fought in the Netherlands-Belgium campaign. He kept a war journal in spite of the fact it was against army regulations. 20 years after the war, when his son was facing the Vietnam War, Pierce turned his journal into a book. Also today, we talk with Barbara Leeming, the author of a new biography of Katharine Hepburn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The White House has announced what it calls significant sanctions against Iran. The sanctions include a ban on trade, new investment, loans, and other financial services. President Clinton signed the executive order Sunday night, and it takes effect in 30 days. A White House statement says the move is to punish Iran for its sponsorship of international terrorism and its active pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. Deadly storms that smashed through Texas and parts of Oklahoma are now over, but they left at least 22 people dead and property damage estimated in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA has more from Dallas.
Tornadoes, hailstorms, lightning, and thunderstorms ravaged North Texas and southern Oklahoma this weekend. As recently as this morning, 63 Texas counties were still under a tornado watch. Yesterday, tornadoes struck Marietta, Oklahoma, killing three. At least five tornadoes touched down in Ardmore, Oklahoma, destroying 35 homes and damaging a tire plant. Closer to the Oklahoma-Texas border, three others died when swirling winds tore homes apart, and a tornado that smashed through the Texas panhandle killed one and injured five. It was a fatal postscript to a series of catastrophic hail and rainstorms in Fort Worth and Dallas Friday that killed 18. A search continues in Dallas for three missing people now presumed dead. The National Weather Service has now removed the tornado watch in North Texas. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
The Senate Budget Committee is considering a Republican plan to balance the federal budget by the year 2002. Committee Chairman Pete Domenici will unveil his proposal tomorrow. It calls for slowing down the rate of Medicare spending and would make major reductions in other non-defense programs.
I believe the time has come to stop shrinking, but shoulder our responsibility and enact an honest federal budget that will stop squandering our nation's economic future.
The committee's ranking Democrat, James Exon of Nebraska, repeated Democratic charges that the GOP will attack federal aid to the poorest Americans to pay for tax breaks for the wealthy. Exon called on Republican leaders to spell out exactly what programs they plan to reduce or eliminate.
I'm concerned we will be handed a mark that is all forest and no trees. Certainly a resolution that will tell us not only where the Republicans won't cut, but more importantly, where they will cut.
The Senate proposal does not include income tax cuts, in contrast with the House Republican plan. The Iraqi government is optimistic about France's new president-elect, conservative Jacques Chirac. The country's official news agency says Chirac will be more likely to push for the lifting of U.N. sanctions against Iraq. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 39.08 at 4380.48 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton observed Victory in Europe Day this morning with ceremonies at Arlington Cemetery and Fort Myer in Virginia. In a speech to World War II veterans, the president thanked them for standing up to the forces of darkness 50 years ago. Because of you, he said, we live in a nation at peace. The president also made reference to the recent Oklahoma City bombing, saying the lesson of World War II is that the country can prevail over evil. While the United States and much of Europe commemorate the victory over fascism today, there was a smaller ceremony at a former Nazi death camp in Croatia, a country now at war. Mike O'Connor reports from Zagreb.
For many of Croatia's citizens, what happened at the Jasenovac death camp has yet to be resolved. It was a place where a Croatian government, acting as a puppet of the Nazis, killed thousands of Jews and Gypsies and others. Perhaps most were Serbs. And today, many Serbs feel that the deaths in the camp have never been properly acknowledged. Part of the reason, they say, they have rebelled and set up their own country. Today, the United States Ambassador to Croatia, Peter Galbraith, commemorated the deaths of the camp and said that the best hope for stopping the current war in Croatia, with its own history of genocide on both sides, was for the Croatian government to convince Serbs they can live in freedom in Croatia today. For National Public Radio, this is Mike O'Connor in Zagreb.
A new survey finds that many childhood accidents could be easily avoided. The National Safe Kids campaign says many parents are not doing such simple things as making children wear seat belts and bike helmets. 79% of adults surveyed said they allowed children under age 9 to cross the street alone, and 44% said they didn't always supervise children under 5 in the bathtub. State workers in Oregon are on strike. Members of the largest employee union walked out after last-minute talks broke down. The workers oppose a measure that requires them to give 6% of their salaries to a pension fund. They say that amounts to a pay cut. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 50th anniversary of VE Day, the day of Allied victory in Europe in World War II. For many people born after the war, it may seem like the distant past. But the men and women who served were shaped by the war, and many of them are still here and can share with us firsthand what it was like to fight in the Second World War. We have two veterans joining us today. Tony Verone fought in the 9th Infantry Division. For the past 7 years, he's commanded his VFW post on Long Island in New York. He began today at a commemorative breakfast and then joined fellow veterans at a memorial service at the National Cemetery in Farmingdale, Long Island. I asked him what fronts he fought on in the war.
Well, I fought from the invasion in Africa. I went through the Africa invasion, which was in Algiers, the closest point to the Germans. And while we fought the French there and carried on from that point, then we went headed in for the Sahara Desert to establish an airport to get some support from the Air Force, give them an airfield to land on. Then we were told we had to get to Kasserine, which was on the outskirts of Algeria. And when we got there, we found that the Germans were so powerful that they overran our positions, and so many of our boys died. I remember moving down toward the front and seeing these tanks going back and the wounded and the jeeps full of dead. And I said to myself, gee, what can we do going down here when these guys are all coming back? There's more of them than there is of us, and yet we have to hold a position. And I was sort of saying this is going to be the end. However, they did attack us. They did surround us, but luckily I got out, and I took about 20 men out with me through some gullies and things there. And when I got back to where the Americans had moved back to, I was so happy we made it. It was very, very hard time at that time because so many of them were ground into the ground by the tanks. They would sit over the foxhole and spin their tank tracks over the bodies of the men that were in the holes, killing them right then and there. And there was nothing you could do except keep fighting and finding a way to get back.
There were times when you had to take over the platoon?
Yes, there were.
What was it like working with new soldiers who weren't...
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
They come to you with just 4, 5, 6 weeks of training, sometimes a little bit more, and when they report to you at night or even in the daytime, you don't know how to tell them how to get the experience they need to survive. So you do the best you could, and then you place them with someone who's been there for a month or a little longer, or as possible, and you give them as much help with an older timer in there that you could. And what usually happens is the man sometimes survives, and sometimes he's gone that same night, that same day, a couple of days later. And sometimes they say, gee, I didn't even get a chance to really know his name. And he could be just a kid of 17 and a half, 18 years old, and wanting to do his bit for this country to keep us safe, democracy as we are. And it breaks you up because you can't see this youth go down. Not that I was much older, but they were just kids, you know. And to me, 2 years made them kids. I mean, two years difference meant an 18-year-old was a kid compared to me.
Did you write home a lot?
I tried.
What would you say in your letters home?
Oh, I told I'd be writing to my mother and my young brother and sisters, and I'd tell them how everything was, that it was good. I never told them. Well, first of all, there was a time when you couldn't even write what you wanted to. It was one of those things where it was censored, so your mother would get a blank letter with her name and your name, and it wasn't really worth it. So I thought the best thing to do is just tell her not to worry. I'm doing fine. I'm getting heavier. I'm stronger. Everything is really, really great, and I'm not in any danger. And try to put them at peace and keep them at peace of mind, because I know how much they were suffering knowing that we might not come home, you know.
How did you find out the war was over? Where were you? Who?
I was on the east, west bank of the Elbe River, and the Russians would tell me, "That's all, yeah, I don't know, it's finished, it's finished, it's finished." And I said, "Oh, great." So that was it. So we hugged each other, and the men of my platoon were hugging each other and patting each other on the back. Gee, it's over, we're safe now, we can really go home, let's plan on going home. And before you know it, we were really worried about, are we going to survive the day? Because I guess when the Russians got a little drinking too much, they started firing across the river at us.
Why? Why were they doing that?
I guess just getting drunk and just firing their weapons. And I said, boy, this is crazy. This is a hell of a time to die after it's all over. But luckily, I kept the men down, and we waited until we were relieved, and that was it. The next day was a little bit better, and we were able to go home. But all night long, they were whooping and howling and drinking and partying over there. And well, I can't blame them for being happy, but firing weapons at us, I felt like we should open up on them, but I didn't want to start another battle with them. And I figured, no, let's just keep our grounds. They're not coming across the river, so we just keep our heads down.
Do you often feel that there's something fundamentally different about people who fought in war and everybody else? That there's something that everybody else will never understand about what it's like to fight in a war?
I'm positive of that. I hardly think anybody could ever, even myself, could ever explain to somebody else what it's like being in combat. When everything is going at you, whether it's machine gun fire, rifle fire, mortars, hand grenades, house-to-house fighting, airplanes dropping bombs on you and strafing you, firing bullets at you, or artillery firing at you. I mean, everything keeps hitting at you, and you keep saying to yourself, how the heck do you live through this? So I don't think anybody can understand it unless they go through it. And I think that's why we have such a tight-knit group in my division. I mean, maybe there were some veterans who weren't as close up to the front lines as we were, and maybe they didn't stay as close as we do. But to us, we still have our two memorial services a year, one in Worcester, Massachusetts in November, and one coming up here on May 20th at the cemetery. We'll have our group down here, local people that will be coming down to pay tribute to the men that we've buried and remind us that we still love those men. We'll never forget them, and that we love each other enough to stay together as long as we're alive. And then we go down to our reunions, which are one in New Orleans this year, and another one will be up at the some of the local places up here in New York. We get together on a small reunion. So four times a year, we definitely meet with a large group. I mean, this is why we don't feel that anybody really knows what a combat man goes through when you live in foxholes, raining on your food if you're ever lucky enough to get food, or sitting in freezing weather with just a raincoat on and no warm clothing. People just can't realize what can go through a person at that time. And you can't even realize what you're thinking of when you're coming down a rope ladder on the side of a ship to get in a little dinghy that's going to bring you to shore and leave you there when he goes back, either to get more or just leaves us there. And it's up to you to save yourself.
May I ask, how did you end up making your living after the war?
I did various jobs, from selling ice cream on a Goodyear truck to home improvements, and I worked as a longshoreman. I wasn't very well educated. I just went through high school and graduated high school, but never got the chance to go to college. So it was just no experience, no engineering bachelor degree or anything else. So I just had to shift around best I could and make a living for the family. But I never borrowed money from anybody. I mean, if I borrowed money from a bank, it was temporary, and then I paid it back. My father always says, keep your name clean, and I try to do that.
After you got back from the war, how long did it take before you felt that you would allow yourself to experience real pleasure again?
It took me a long time. I did a lot of drinking. Didn't care too much about nothing. I know I wanted to make up time, lost time, but couldn't do that. But I took care of my mom, and I did the best I could with making a few dollars to pay the rent and keep us together. But it must have taken me a good couple of years before I really felt, hey, I just can't be this stupid to waste my life now. Start buckling down and work hard at making the best of life and get married. And I kept in touch with my girl from high school, and that's the one I married.
Mm-hmm.
So Viola and I are happy, and we've been married for 47 years now.
Tony Verone now commands a VFW post on Long Island. We'll hear more experiences of World War II after a break. This is Fresh Air. Donald Pierce was an infantry platoon commander with the Canadian Army from June of 1944 to May of 45. He fought in the Netherlands-Belgium campaign. He kept a journal, hoping that if he died, he'd leave behind a record of what the war was like. Both he and his journal came out of the war intact. 20 years after the war ended, he adapted his journal into a memoir called Journal of a War. Pierce, who is a longtime American citizen, recently retired from teaching English at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He now teaches literature in an adult education program. Earlier today, he told me that keeping a journal was in part an act of self-preservation after he was plunged from graduate school into foxholes. But keeping a journal violated Army regulations. If he were captured, it would have given information to the enemy. He told me he recorded his memories on whatever papers he could scrounge.
I would stuff the papers in my pack, you know, and then every now and then when I had a chance, send them back to B Echelon, and there they'd remain for me. If I came out of the war alive, I'd have them. So I just kept doing that, and it was just a way of keeping alive, because I knew there was a me that was going to have to go back to normal civilized life eventually, and I wanted to keep it alive. That's really the only way I can, excepting, you know, it's a little more than that. It's not just that desperate. It was fascinating, a fascinating life being in the Army. Everybody, anyone who thinks that it is a gross experience is only giving you part of the truth. It's actually also very exhilarating. It was one of the greatest educational experiences I ever had.
You wrote these memoirs in the mid-40s during the war. It wasn't published until 1965, I believe it was. What was the occasion for actually turning these memoirs into a book?
I wrote this journal with the intention of leaving a memoir of myself and what things were like for my son, because I didn't really expect to come back. And then when I did, you know, survive the war, it just sort of got tucked away in a drawer for quite a long time, or in a trunk. And one day when he was faced with the probability of his own war, which would have been Vietnam, he asked me if he could see that journal that he said I had written. So I dug it out, and I showed him some passages, and he wanted to read the whole thing, which he did. thought it was great. And I said, okay, maybe we'll put this together. And I did. And that was how it came to be delayed in publication.
You fought in the Netherlands-Belgium campaign.
Yeah.
Would you describe what it was like there? I mean, just physically, what the area was like at the end of the war.
Well, the Canadian Army had been given the job of, at that point when I came in, the job of clearing out pockets of German resistance, and they were numerous in the Netherlands, Belgium, northern France area. This was considered to be some kind of a mopping up operation. They were given that. And so right away, we were faced with dikes and narrow roads and flooded fields and all kinds of physical, nasty physical obstacles and conditions. And we got pretty well adjusted to that. We had all kinds of ways of coping with it. We had things that were called, for instance, water buffaloes, large tank-like vehicles in which maybe 20 or 25 soldiers could be put, and then they had blades, sort of like, not propellers, but blades for tracks, and they could go through muddy or through flooded fields. We would sometimes go from one point to another, taking barn by barn, or little intersection by intersection, house by house, farmhouses and whatever, slowly. And the Germans were yielding very grudgingly. They fought pretty well, but we outnumbered them, and we had better equipment. Our morale was much higher, and so as a result, we gradually, bit by bit, inch by inch, chewed our way through that. And the main object of all that work was to clear the channel ports of Antwerp and Ostend and, you know, Calais and other places like that, so that they would be open for Allied materiel.
How did your nerves change over time?
Oh, I got exhausted. And, you know, at first you don't feel anything. I remember the first experience of battle I ever had when I was fired at. I didn't realize I was being fired at. I heard this thing go whap past my head. Couldn't have been more than a couple of inches away from me. That didn't mean too much to me until somebody said, get down, get down. So I did, and then I realized suddenly that I was a target. From then on, you become aware, you know, of this, and you're not happy about being a human target. And in due time, you, as I did in my own particular case, you become really quite tired out from that constant strain and don't like it in the least. Don't look forward to it, and are awful glad when it's over.
Did you worry any more or less about dying as you spent more time as a soldier?
No, I don't think I ever worried about dying. You know, maybe getting blown up or shot or something or you know, a painful situation, but it's more mysterious than that. I think you just get more apprehensive of you don't know what exactly, and you don't look forward to the next operation and that kind of attitude, but it's not a question of thinking about death. I never talked about that with any soldier. As a matter of fact, I think that was really very taboo. Soldiers never exchanged ideas about that. They became really very ironic and very amusing about that subject. If someone was killed, they never sat down and grieved, or they never shook their head or anything. They said, Jesus, you know, he got it. God, I can't believe it. Well, there it goes. Too bad old Joe, or something like that, you know. It's just the way people... I suppose in any kind of rough activity, football or something like that, you know, may very well feel when they're in the midst of things. They don't grieve about how they feel, how it hurts or anything like that. They're too busy thinking about the plan that they have immediately to execute. So, no, it wasn't a question of carrying around a serious worry about death.
Were there promises that you'd made to yourself during the war, and did you keep those promises after the war ended?
Oh, I sure did. Oh, yeah. There were other selfish promises, in a way. They were that I was to make something out of myself, that I was to not allow myself to sink into some routine job or just become an anticlimax. No, no, I owed it to all the people whom I had come to love in the war and who are now dead. I sort of owed it to them, I felt, to give a true account of myself at the end. And I tried to do that. I went back to university, finished my PhD degree, and I was just sort of in heaven. I just got back into the work that I really loved, and I gave myself to it with a good deal of enthusiasm and vigor, and I think ability, right on through. And so, in a sense, you know, I got a very nice payoff from it all, which was that I've never, in a sense, worked a day in my life. It's always been such a pleasure to teach students and read the material that I have worked with. Hasn't been work, it's been play.
What does VE Day mean to you today?
It means two things. First of all, what it meant at the time, the victory of democracy over fascism. That was VE Day, and that was a great cause for rejoicing from one end of Europe to another. Even the Germans loved VE Day. As the Allied armies went on through Germany, you know, they turned out and cheered them in the streets as they came by. Can you imagine? What does that mean? I don't know. But VE Day was a happy day on both sides, I think, of the war. But it also meant something else. It meant that something, for me, something had come to an end. And, you know, I can't help thinking of what was lost. Not just what we won and what we saved, but what was lost. And what was lost, as I see it, was some working encyclopedia or lexicon or functioning arrangement of values and meanings that had been coherent and continuous down through history. It seems to me was shot to pieces in that war, especially if you add World War I to it. The arrangements of European or Western civilization were really battered, you know, to pieces. And we're living, in a way, among the fragments of that right now. And we've even given it a fancy name. We call it postmodernism. And there's something good about it and very challenging about postmodernism and about living in the fragments. Everybody has to cook up his values and cook up his reasons and think for himself and try to make arrangements in his own small world. But when you think about the huge world out there, you know, we don't have the tools or the vocabulary anymore to address it coherently. So we're having to work something out. Something is over. And something is about to begin, or at least needs to begin. And so VE Day means that, you know, somehow or other. A civilization blew itself apart, attempting to defend itself from a part of itself. And we still haven't put it back together again in a new fashion.
Donald Pierce teaches in Santa Barbara. His memoir, Journal of a War, was published in 1965. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Barbara Leeming about her new biography of Katharine Hepburn. The book also tells the story of Hepburn's mother, a suffragist and activist for birth control rights. Also, let's get cynical. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of songs by Steve Beresford. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton has signed an executive order imposing sanctions against Iran. The order bans trade, loans, and other financial services. A White House statement says the action is in response to what it calls Iran's support for international terrorism and the country's effort to obtain weapons of mass destruction. The president left Washington for Moscow today to join other leaders in celebrations of the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe. As he boarded his plane, the president urged Congress to pass his anti-terrorism bill, especially in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. UPI's Carol Van Dam has the story.
President Clinton urged the Republican-controlled Congress to quickly sign, seal, and deliver the anti-terrorism legislation he sent to the Hill, broadening federal law enforcement surveillance powers, and urged Republicans to steer clear of turning the bill into a political football.
There is simply no reason to delay it. Nothing can justify it, and it needs to pass, and pass now.
GOP leaders have vowed to have the bill on the president's desk by Memorial Day. Mr. Clinton made his remarks at Andrews Air Force Base before boarding Air Force One for Russia. The president and first lady will attend the high point of VE Day commemorations in Moscow tomorrow. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
Oklahoma and Texas residents are trying to recover from violent storms that hit over the weekend. 18 people were killed in Texas, 3 in Oklahoma. Damages are estimated in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Rain is still falling in northern Texas, and tornado watches are in effect in the east and south. In Missouri, 2 people were killed early today when high winds knocked down mobile homes and power lines. 18,000 state workers are on strike in Oregon. Public employees are demanding a 6.5% pay raise. Colin Fogarty of Oregon Public Broadcasting has the story from Portland.
Workers in state agencies from Children's Services Division to the Department of Motor Vehicles took to the picket lines early this morning. 11th-hour negotiations last night failed to yield any movement from state and union negotiators. The state says it can't afford the 6.5% pay raise the union is demanding. Union leaders argue the state has the money if the legislature would include it in the state's budget. Tensions between the state and the union erupted last year after voters approved a ballot measure that requires public workers to contribute 6% of their pay toward their pensions. The workers say it effectively cuts their pay by 6%. Union leaders have told their members to be ready to strike for at least 3 days, but add that the strike could last, in their words, as long as it takes. For National Public Radio, I'm Colin Fogarty in Portland.
Michigan Dr. Jack Kevorkian has apparently helped another person kill himself. Kevorkian lawyer Jeffrey Feiger says his client was present at the death of a 78-year-old man who suffered from lung disease. On Wall Street, stocks closed at a record high today. The Dow closed at 4383.87. This is NPR News. The wives of 2 American men being held in Iraq will leave Baghdad this week. Linda Barloon and Kathy Daliberti have been allowed to visit their husbands every day, but they failed to get a meeting with top Iraqi officials. Mrs. Barloon says the 2 will keep pushing, but will leave for Jordan on Thursday. More than a month ago, William Barloon and David Daliberti were arrested and sentenced to 8 years in prison for crossing into Iraq from Kuwait. 2 musicals, Showboat and Sunset Boulevard, are leading the field in this year's Tony Award nominations. From member station WNYC in New York, Dick Henschliff reports.
The lavish production of Showboat, directed by Hal Prince, has captured 10 nominations, including Best Musical Revival, Best Actress in a Musical, Rebecca Luker, and Best Actor, Mark Jacoby and John McMartin. Runner-up with 9 nominations is Sunset Boulevard, a guaranteed winner for Best Score and Best Book of a Musical, categories where it has no competition. Glenn Close is up for Best Actress in a Musical, and Alan Campbell for Best Actor. Among the Best Play nominations are Jean Cocteau's Indiscretions, written in 1938 but never before presented on Broadway. The drama drew 9 nominations. When the winners are announced June 4th, 2 people will receive Lifetime Achievement Awards. Actress Carol Channing, star of the current revival of Hello, Dolly, and Harvey Sabinson, head of the League of American Theaters and Producers. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The Japanese government says it is prepared to resume automobile trade talks with the United States if the Clinton administration will drop its demand for so-called voluntary purchase agreements. Those agreements tell Japanese carmakers to buy a specified level of American car parts. The trade negotiations collapsed over the issue on Friday, and the White House is expected to retaliate with major tariffs on Japanese imports. If that happens, Tokyo will file an unfair trading case with the new World Trade Organization. Japanese officials repeated that promise today. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Barbara Leeming has written a new biography of Katharine Hepburn, one of Hollywood's most private public figures. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin calls the book more gripping than anything the star has played on screen. Leeming is also the author of biographies of Orson Welles, Rita Hayworth, and Betty Davis, and is a former film professor at Hunter College in New York. In her biography of Hepburn, Leeming examines the family history that shaped the great actress. Hepburn's grandmother was a great believer in education for women. Hepburn's mother was a suffragist and birth control rights activist. Katharine Hepburn's brother committed suicide when he was 15. The biography starts with the mystery surrounding the suicide of Katharine Hepburn's grandfather in 1892.
What you find when you examine that suicide is that it's a suicide which involves a younger sister, a devoted younger sister. And the questions that Kate's grandfather left his sister with, was it somehow my fault? Was there some way that I could have prevented my brother doing this? Why did he involve me in his suicide? He could have killed himself in any number of other ways. Why did he choose somehow or other to implicate me in it? Was that somehow a gesture of anger against me? Those questions, even though Kate did not know that they had been asked, were eerily repeated years and years and years later in 1921 when Kate, at the age of 13, walked into an attic in Greenwich Village and discovered her 15-year-old brother hanging by the neck.
Did Katharine Hepburn talk with you about the impact of her brother's suicide and the impact of discovering his body?
No. What Kate does with her brother's suicide is a fascinating thing, and she talks about this also in her autobiography. Kate's take on her brother's suicide has always been that it may have been an accident, it may have been suicide. What fascinated me when I went back and looked at the police reports, looked at the autopsy reports, and went back to her early statements to the police was that, first of all, there is no question, and never was any question, that the brother did commit suicide. He comes from a family in which there are 5 other suicides, so it's not terribly surprising. However, her father's reaction to the suicide was, obviously, as any parent would be, he was devastated. This was his oldest son. As somebody said, it was like the prince of the family. And he could not bear the thought that his son had killed himself. And so the minute that her father was brought on the scene, he began to try and find ways to see it as an accident, to deny the suicide. And that happens with parents all the time. 2 days after the suicide, Kate and her father had a very traumatic telephone conversation in which this 13-year-old girl clearly realized that it was important, it was impossible for her father to admit what had happened. Before this, no one had been questioning it. The little girl knew clearly what had happened. By the time she got off the phone with her father, Kate had decided something. And it's, to me, the moment when she really becomes that courageous Katharine Hepburn figure that we all know. She had decided that it was more important to protect her father than it was for her to be able to deal with what horror she had seen in that attic bedroom. And so from then on, she went along with her father's story, which is the story that we've all heard and that was in the papers and so forth afterwards. And that is that the boy had killed himself accidentally playing a childish prank, trying to hang himself.
In Hollywood, Katharine Hepburn almost symbolized a certain streak of independence, of an independent woman. You know, her image in movies.
Yes.
Her mother was a suffragist and birth control activist. What were her mother's greatest accomplishments? How important a player was she in the movement?
Her mother was a major tactician of the National Women's Party. She was the president of the Connecticut Women's Suffrage Association before that. And she was one of the most radical of the suffragists. I had not been aware of the kind of violence that was done to the women, how hard it was for the women to get the vote. And what I realized in telling her mother's story was how much being brought up in what I came to think of as the war room of the Connecticut women's suffrage thing and of the National Women's Party meetings as well, what that had done to the little girl, Kathy Houghton. One of the things actually I asked Kate about, I remember reading letters from her mother and to her mother from other suffragists, and they're discussing what was called force feeding, when the suffragists would go on hunger strikes and they would be force fed in prison. Tubes would be stuck down their throats and the women would vomit and blood would come out of their noses, and the letters were horrific. And I knew that little Kathy Hepburn had been sitting at the table hearing this. And I said to Kate when I interviewed her, I said, "Weren't you terrified by this?" And she looked at me and those blue eyes just lit up and she said, "No, I thought it was exciting." And of course, she did. You know, what growing up in that did was to give her a taste for danger, a taste for life lived on the edge, and also a kind of fearlessness that reminds me sometimes of children who lived through the war and who speak later about the intensity of that kind of experience. It was a crucial experience for Kate.
Was Katharine Hepburn's mother's activism ever held against Katharine Hepburn during her acting career?
Yes, it was. And it was one of the things that her mother worried about a great deal. In fact, at the time that Kate really became absolutely a gigantic star with the success of Little Women, the original Little Women, and when Kate played Jo, I mean, everybody fell in love with her. But it coincided with the moment that Mrs. Hepburn and Margaret Sanger were being attacked for the birth control activism. And there was an enormous amount of fear that Kate would lose her audience and that the studio would go mad. And I found a wonderful letter from Kate to Sanger, who had written to her and said, "You know, your mother is really upset and we don't want to do anything that's going to cause you problems." And Kate wrote back to Sanger and said, "Don't worry about me. I can take whatever they dish out. What you and mother are doing is what is important." Well, I mean, you have to really like Hepburn for that, because it did count. And it was held against her, but she just went ahead.
Barbara Leeming is my guest. She's the author of a new biography of Katharine Hepburn. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Barbara Leeming. She's written a new biography of Katharine Hepburn. You write a lot about Katharine Hepburn's private life, which is something that I don't think Katharine Hepburn was ever anxious to disclose herself. And you say that she was drawn to a quality in men that you describe as an oversensitivity to life.
She describes it that way, actually. Repeatedly, when she's talking, particularly when she's talking about John Ford and Spencer Tracy, who were the two major relationships of her adult life, both of them were tremendously self-destructive men. They were men who were extremely complicated and very hard on themselves. Both of them were alcoholics. Both of them were tormented. Ford, I think, is a much more sympathetic figure in so many ways, just because he had much less difficulty dealing. He loved Kate's intelligence. He loved her feistiness. He loved her independence, whereas Tracy, I think, ultimately was quite threatened by it. But I think that what Kate was drawn to in both men was the sense that they needed her. And like her mother and her grandmother before her, she was someone who saw herself as stronger than the men who seemed on the surface to dominate her. She was dedicated, I think, to making Ford happy, trying to make him happy, and then later to literally saving Tracy's life. She clearly saw these men later on as somehow similar to her brother's immense talent and sensitivity. And she seems to have been determined that what had happened to her brother Tom was never going to happen to these men that she loved. And she was never going to open another door, as she repeatedly puts it in her own autobiography, and find one of the people that she loved dead behind that door. And of course, the great tragedy was that she literally opened a door and found Spencer Tracy dead at a certain point. It's a horrific, horrific way to go through life, fearing that.
Well, it's a paradox that the two men she loved most, who really needed her, director John Ford and actor Spencer Tracy, were two married men who, in a way, didn't have room in their life for her, not for a marriage relationship anyway.
Yes, it was a very, it was a very sad thing. I don't think, certainly there was no evidence that she deliberately looked for married men. I think it was the wounded quality, it was the self-destructive quality that attracted her. I think they happened to be married. But I think that was a great cost to Kate, because it was obvious that she wanted to marry both of them. I mean, she's always said, oh, it didn't matter to her that Spencer Tracy didn't ever marry her. Well, obviously it did matter to her. That's very clear in letters and in testimony. And she clearly wanted to have children. So, and she had so much to give. But the relationship with Tracy especially is so at odds with the public image of that relationship, and yet the myth of that relationship has such a hold on all of us because we think we know about it because we've seen it in the movies, but movies are obviously not real life. Yet, if you've lived for years and years and years watching Tracy and Hepburn together on the screen, it certainly doesn't prepare you for the private relationship that I saw documented time and again in letters. Very different.
What are some of the most obvious ways that their relationship was different in real life than it was in their movies?
Well, I think the thing that surprised me most was how instantaneous the change in Kate took place after she got involved with Tracy. A note of hysteria came into her voice immediately upon that, because she was terrified to be apart from him, and she immediately sensed how troubled he was. I mean, as awful as he is at times, you have to feel sorry for him. He's a deeply troubled person. And I remember, for example, reading a letter that Kate wrote to Philip Barry's wife, the playwright who wrote the Philadelphia Story, at the time that she and Tracy were making the film Without Love. And Kate is saying, Spencer thinks he's going mad. Spencer hasn't slept for weeks. Spencer, what am I going to do? And there's this same sense of incredible desperation. Kate seemed to go through a whole series of changes, particularly in the first decade that she was with Tracy, of trying one thing and then the next to find some way to pull him out of this. First, it was keeping him really busy. Then it was making sure that he didn't drink. And then it was saying, okay, it's all right, I'm not going to stop him from doing it. Then it was getting him to rest. And she just couldn't find a way to save him. And ultimately, she realized that, and all she could do was to stand by and try and support him.
How much was known about Katharine Hepburn's relationship with director John Ford before your biography?
Well, in fact, that relationship has been referred to in every one of the major Ford biographies. It's not a surprise at all. I think what is different about this is that I, for the first time, really tried to understand what that relationship was about. Because one of the questions that people have asked, particularly in the Ford biographies, because they don't know very much about Hepburn, is why was Katharine Hepburn drawn to someone like John Ford? And why was he drawn to her? And I thought that the responsibility of the Hepburn biographer was to see what it was in that relationship. What was so extraordinary to me, and it was an unconsummated relationship. And because of that, there is a kind of passion all the way through, long after. I mean, they fell in love in 1936 when he was directing her in Mary of Scotland. But they remained friends until the end of his life in 1973. Ford wanted the best for Kate and saw the best in her and was a very loyal and very important friend to her. And it was a wonderful kind of example of what male and female friendship can be all about, even when there's a past history of great pain in it.
And they never consummated because he was married.
Because he was, and I think he wanted, I don't think that's what he wanted from her. I think Tracy never wanted to marry her. I think Ford was deeply in love with her and certainly wanted to marry her. I mean, John Wayne has said that, and his wife has talked about it in her biography of her husband, that there, Wayne's sense was that Ford would have married her in a minute if he could have brought himself to leave his wife. But again, it's a very tormented man, and his ties to his wife were important to him. And he was, again, somebody who seemed almost at times not to believe that he should be happy. But you certainly, when you're reading the Ford section, I think you feel, oh, I wish this could have happened. I mean, he somehow or other, he did seem in so many ways so right for her. It's an extraordinary thing.
What do you know about Katharine Hepburn's life today?
I haven't seen her since 1993 when I interviewed her. I know her brother actually has read the book and responded to me in an absolutely wonderful, two wonderful letters saying that he thought I'd done a fantastic job. Kate herself, I doubt, will ever read the book. I mean, it's not the sort of thing, she's not introspective. She's not going to go back and look at it. She is still an astonishing example to every woman alive of what can happen if you live life as intensely as you can at every moment. And I came out of working on the book feeling that I respected her more, if possible, than I had before, because I think I saw her pain as well. And it's a pain that she's been at great pains not to let us see. And I think you only love her more when you know how much she suffered.
Barbara Leeming, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to come.
Barbara Leeming is the author of a new biography of Katharine Hepburn. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what are you doing to commemorate VE Day?
Hi, Terry. We'll be listening in on various VE Day observances in Europe. Also, President Clinton is speaking at Arlington National Cemetery today. I'll be talking with some schoolchildren in Dayton, Ohio, about letters they've received from World War II veterans. The Senate Budget Committee takes up the 1996 federal budget. I'll talk with BBC reporter Bob Simpson in Sarajevo about recent shelling in Bosnia. And Alan Chews reviews the new book, Father of Frankenstein.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. England's Steve Beresford plays piano and cheap sampling keyboards designed for kids. He also sings songs he writes with his longtime lyricist Andrew Brenner. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes Beresford the pianist and Beresford the singer-songwriter.
Sitting here happy and talky with the sense of the start of the cynical. You want to put down somebody? And I'm here to make sure it's clinical. Let's strike while the iron is hot. I'm burning to be better for it. There's so much that we can destroy. Who cares if we can't then restore it? Let's get cynical. Why fight the feeling? Breathe deep the intoxicant air. Together we'll push back the ceiling. We'll go where the others don't dare.
I don't care.
When Steve Beresford began jamming with serious-minded free improvisers in the 1970s, some of them grumbled whenever he walked on stage. They couldn't figure out if he was putting them on or not. That's Beresford. You listen to the songs on his new album, Steve Beresford's Signals for Tea, and you gotta wonder if he's for real. Some of his tunes sound like parodies of standard songs, and Andrew Brenner's lyrics walk the line between pathos and slapstick. Their song, Unremarkable, is a takeoff on laundry list numbers like My Favorite Things, except it celebrates the blissfully ordinary. But it eventually reveals itself to be a bittersweet love song.
A broken twig, a canceled gig, unremarkable. TV white noise, old duck decoys, unremarkable. An inner sleeve, a fallen leaf, so unremarkable. cups of tea, my other name, unremarkable. Take me and you, isn't that unremarkable too? We're certainly not together, no, not no tie, no tether. A gob of phlegm, a tattered hem, unremarkable.
Steve Beresford's Signals for Tea is that rare album on which the word phlegm appears in more than one lyric. His band is saxophonist John Zorn's quartet Masada, with trumpeter Dave Douglas, bassist Greg Cohen, and an excellent young drummer, Kenny Wallison. Their generally light touch goes well with Beresford's piano, which is part Thelonious Monk and part Chico Marx. It's hard to be that cute and get away with it, but for me, Steve Beresford pulls it off. Unfortunately for consumers, his album Signals for Tea is on John Zorn's Japanese label, Avant. Its American distributor, and Zorn himself, seem determined to keep the label secret from the public. They don't advertise, and they send out almost no review copies. Zorn hates critics, even sympathetic ones, but even bad critics call attention to what's out there. The Avant catalog has some fine CDs by trombonist George Lewis, harpist Zena Parkins, pianist Misha Mengelberg, and many more. But good luck finding them.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Steve Beresford's Signals for Tea on Avant Records, distributed by Sphere Marketing. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers. With Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.